If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey everyone, Seth Meyers here. Welcome to another edition of our podcast series, Late Night Lit, where we shine a spotlight on some of our favorite voices in the world of literature. Now I'm going to turn things once again over to one of our late night producers, Sarah Jenks Daly. Take it away, Sarah.
Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, and welcome back to Late Night Lit. This month, we are so fortunate to speak with National Book Award finalist Disha Filya, the author of the fantastic collection of short stories, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. We also chat with one of the most beloved figures in the New York publishing community, Todd Dowdy, who is the senior VP and deputy publisher at Doubleday. Wherever you find yourself during this very surreal and very strange holiday season, we hope you will be inspired by and enjoy listening to these conversations with Disha and Todd, and that you'll find some time to read. The Secret Lives of Church Ladies is a remarkable debut collection of short stories that examine the lives of Black women, spanning generations and exploring topics such as sex, religion, and the sometimes hidden lessons and truths that exist within those stories. It is beautifully written and moves seamlessly through the different narrative perspectives. Now, here is my chat with Disha Filya. Hi, Disha. Welcome to Late Night Lit. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I want to start with congratulating you on being a finalist for the National Book Awards. And I know it probably wasn't the result you were hoping for, but it must have been thrilling to have been recognized on that scale for this book.
Thrilling. I was stunned, just beyond thrilled, really. And especially to be in such great company. I don't know if you had a chance to read the other books, but that, you know, just magnified the honor. Those are some really great books.
You mentioned when we were talking before that, are you still sort of surprised and impressed when people have read the book?
I am. You know, it's a short book. It's short stories, which don't get a lot of play. It's on a university press. You know, I've always loved the book, but I didn't ever imagine that it would have this kind of reach and that it would affect so many people from so many different backgrounds so deeply. I'm thrilled about that, but I never thought about it.
Where were you when you found out that it was nominated for the fiction prize?
So, you know, there's the long list and the short list. The long list, I was on a call with a collaborator on a workshop and was multitasking as we do. And someone sent me congratulations in a Facebook message. And I knew that the fiction list was coming out that morning, but it didn't dawn on me that that's what I was being congratulated for. And it wasn't until they dropped the link to the nominations and I could see the headline, I just started screaming. And I haven't really stopped screaming.
And then when you got down to the shortlist, you just continued to scream throughout the process.
Yeah. So I knew when the shortlist was coming out and we were watching for it. I was with my daughters that morning and I think we had every device open and we were like, you know, furiously checking and refreshing. And my oldest daughter, Taylor, was sitting next to me and she saw it first and she said, "You got it." And I guess I screamed and threw my hands up. And like hours later, she was like, "You know, you hit me in the face." I said, "No, I didn't realize I hit you in the face." So I've had very visceral reactions to this.
Well, the book is wonderful. And I'm so glad that you're getting that reaction from people who've been reading it and loving it. And it really lives up to its title in The Secret Lives of Church Ladies in the way that the women are the main characters and frequently mm-hmm. also the supporting characters, and men really are just ancillary. Was that the direction that you always wanted this collection to take, or did that kind of organically happen as you were putting it together?
It was really organic, and my friend Damon Young summarized it best after he read the book. He said, "Men are garnish in this book," and I really like that, not just because, you know, men are garnished, but because it means that women are the meal, you know, we're the main course. And that was always my intention, to center Black women and, you know, what are the secrets? What are the things that we only tell each other or that maybe we only tell ourselves? And so by having that be the focus, you know, the result is what you see, what you read. And too often we're marginalized in our own stories or misrepresented. And so to be able to tell the truth and the whole truth and center Black women in their own narratives was really important to me.
Yeah, you mentioned Black women, and I read that you were inspired by both Toni Morrison and August Wilson when you were writing this, mm-hmm. and in the sense that the focus of these stories is on Black women and their perspective. Can you talk about how they helped you through this creative process?
Yes. So, you know, the boldness, the audacity, the tenacity of Toni Morrison and August Wilson, they're great role models in so many respects, but in that way in particular, they are unapologetic about what they choose to write about. You know, in both cases, they wrote what interested them, they wrote what they were passionate about, and they made it clear that Black life is so full, that there's nothing about the human condition. There's nothing, you know, when we talk about universal, that you can tell a universal story through Black people's lives and our voices. And they did that with such confidence, and they did it with such excellence as well. And, you know, that's what I aspire to do also.
I think that's wonderful. Were those two people writers that you found yourself reading more as you started writing more, or were those people that were always writers that you read throughout your life?
So Toni Morrison, I've been reading since I was a teenager. And she's also someone that, like James Baldwin, you just read and reread, you
right.
come back to them. And at every different stage of my life, I see something new because I'm new, I'm different. And then the books change you and there's just this cycle. With August Wilson, I came to his work later in life as a Pittsburgher. I knew who he was, but did not know his work nearly as well as I knew Toni Morrison's work. And then I was the manager for the National August Wilson Education Project that came out about 5 years ago in support of the American Masters documentary about his life. And so I immersed myself in all things August Wilson, in the plays, in his biography, in the neighborhood that he lives in. It's, you know, it's in the Hill District, and that's just down the road from where I live. And so I wasn't just reading the plays, but also reading his interviews where, you know, he spoke with such boldness about, and he, you know, he was talking about not Black, just Black storytelling, but also Black theater. Mm-hmm. And so the politics of the choices that he made and how he just was unwavering really inspired me and encouraged me.
How do you think the role of religion in your life, or perhaps the practice of going to church or the role mm-hmm. that church played in your life, contributed to this collection? Was that a part of your childhood and something you had written about before, something you knew you wanted to write about?
So when I started writing, you know, sort of the seeds, you know, the very beginnings of all of this before I knew it would be a collection was about 20 years ago. And I was attempting to write novels.
Okay.
And I wasn't thinking specifically church ladies as a concept. I was thinking dissatisfied women, because that's what I was at that time. And the church part of it came because the church is in me, and that I was sent to church from a very young age. And I say sent because I was raised by my mother and her mother, my grandmother, and they sent me to church, but they didn't always go to church. And they didn't become church goers until I was in college. So, you know, I'm watching that and I'm mesmerized by the women inside the church and that dichotomy of being in the church or out of the church. And then the two women that I love most in life aren't in the church, but I'm there and I'm told that you have to be there to, you know, to go to heaven and all of these mm-hmm. binaries, heaven and hell and good and bad and good girl, bad girl. And I'm watching the women and wondering about them. And then puberty hits and you start wondering, you know, do they have sex? Well, they have kids, so they must have sex. Do they like sex? Do they masturbate? You know, I was a very curious child. Of course, I would never ask the church ladies these things, but I definitely watched them. And because that was, you know, imprinted on me in a way, when you're trying to figure out who you're going to be in the world and what does it mean to be a woman, when I started exploring things in my fiction, they came back, their voices came back, those questions I had came back. And so even when I wasn't thinking of it conceptually as church stories, those are the characters that came back time and time again.
You mentioned you started working on this a long time ago, and I'm mm-hmm. sure it was an interesting process. Did you have an idea of how you wanted to organize them? Like, did you spend time moving them around in different orders before it was published?
So I started the collection because I wasn't able to finish a novel. One of the mini novel, I've started three different novels, and there was one that really had legs and that I started in 2007. And then I stalled on it. And there are a number of reasons that have to do with craft why I stalled, but I was stalled. But in the meantime, I started writing these stories, and my agent had heard me read these stories at some events. And by the second time, she said, you know, I really like these church lady stories. And I hadn't thought of them that way, but she did. And she said, maybe while you're, you know, taking a break from the novel, and she's being very generous with that break, you know, maybe you could put together a short story collection. And that felt a little less daunting. Not that it's easy, but it just didn't feel as overwhelming than going back to a novel that I've been stuck on for so long. And so that's when I got really intentional about, okay, there are going to be themes throughout Black women, sex, the Black church. But, you know, beyond that, there could be a lot of diversity. And so when I was writing the stories, I wasn't thinking sequence or anything like that. It just, you know, had some different things that it could have been a line of dialogue I heard somewhere in my head or heard out in the world, you know, 3 years ago, like, what can I do with this? Or in a case of one of the stories, I'd written maybe 10 to 15 pages of a story, and I ended up pulling two paragraphs out of that and building a story around that. So when it came time to sequence the stories for the collection, I like things that, you know, like satisfying endings. They may not be happy, but satisfying. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of embodied like, huh, a sigh, you know? So I knew which story was last. I knew when Eddie Levert comes, that felt like right. a sigh. It wasn't the last story I wrote though, but that's the one I felt was sort of the end. And I knew that Eula should be first, because I just feel like with Eula, you don't ease into it.
No,
it's everything that's going to come next. All the major themes are there. It's provocative. It's erotic. And so I figure readers can read that and know whether or not they want to continue. So, and it was a little sentimental because Eula was the first of the stories to be published elsewhere. And that was the challenge that my agent gave me, which is if we can get three of these stories published, we can market this collection on the strength of a partial manuscript with three stories published. And so I was like, all right, so I got the first one done, you know, and so, you know, Eula will always be close to my heart for that reason. And then after that, I wanted to break up rhythm, right? I didn't want two really long stories following each other and then tone, you know, something really heavy followed by something a little lighter. Like Dear Sister is long and it has some heavy themes, but it, I think, is the funniest story in the collection. So those are the kinds of things I thought about with sequencing.
I loved all of the stories. I think my favorite was actually How to Make Love to a Physicist. That one was
one of mine too.
I just love that one so much. I also loved the one where the couple moves to the Northeast from the South.
Snowfall.
Those are my favorites. those probably both end with a nice sigh. I think that speaks yes. more to what I was looking for. But when people talk to you about the book, do you find that they have the same favorites? What are the ones mm-hmm. that most frequently come up when they talk to you about how much they loved it?
Peach Cobbler, hands down, seems to be most people's favorite. And I think it's because you can't walk away from that story and not feel something. Mm-hmm. And it's either you, the main character, you know, you're just devastated by what has happened to her. And then the not knowing of what happens next. And her, she didn't know. And so as readers, we don't know either.
Right.
And then there's a lot of really strong feelings towards the mother, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that's the one that shakes people up the most. But then some people have picked up on the fact that we do see Olivia, the main character, again later in one of the stories. And so that was not conscious on my part. I was writing that later story. It was actually the last story I wrote. And I think that Olivia from Peach Cobbler was still in my subconscious and I needed to know what happened. And I started writing that last story, and there's the line about the Peach Cobbler. And I kind of gasped myself and I was like, it's her, it's her. And that felt right. Even if, you know, we can debate about if she had a happy ending or not, mm-hmm. but it felt right that we did get some closure.
Yes. Yes. With her. I love that. Finally, I would love to ask if there are any books that you would recommend to our listeners that you've recently read and loved.
Oh gosh, so many. Let's see. Definitely The Prophets by Robert Johnson. I don't even know if that one's out yet, but it might be available for pre-order. And I'm going to mangle this title if I don't look it up, but I think it's Milk, Blood, Heat, and it's by Danthiel Moniz. And we're actually from the same hometown. I got it right. Milk, Blood, Heat.
Okay, great.
And it's also forthcoming. And it's actually set in our hometown of Jacksonville, Florida. And I was reading an early copy of it. And just in the first 14 pages, I, you know, gasped. I gasped a lot, I guess. And I actually had to text her and said, you did this. You really did this. It is breathtaking. Both of those books, The Prophets, plural, and Milk, Blood, Heat.
Okay, great. I look forward to reading those. It was so nice to talk to you. Thank you again for joining us. And for everyone, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies is available wherever books are sold, but please support your local and independent bookstores. Thank you again, Deesha.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with Todd Dowdy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Todd Dowdy is a senior VP and deputy publisher at Doubleday. He works with an amazing slate of authors, including Margaret Atwood, John Grisham, and others. When this pandemic began in March, he embarked upon a personal project, which recently turned into a book deal of his own. Here's my chat with Todd Dowdy. Hi, Todd. Welcome to Late Night Lit. I am so appreciative that you agreed to talk to us.
Thanks so much for having me. Longtime listener, first time caller.
So I think this interview will probably be more familiar than I'm used to because we are not only colleagues, but we've developed a friendship over the last few years. So I thought we could start with how we met and why we know each other.
Sure. So I have worked at Doubleday for the past 15 years and am part of the publicity department there. And you have been very kind to us and our authors over the years, as has Seth. So I'm trying to think what our first, would it have been Hanya for A Little Life?
Yes, I think Hanya Yanagihara's A Little Life was the first book that really broke the mold for us in terms of feeling like we could have novelists on the show as talk show guests.
It was a great interview. I mean, Hanya is fascinating, and the way she and Seth clicked, like if folks haven't seen it, they should look it up because, you know, she's talking about a 700 page novel, mm-hmm. and just the way that they were able to bring it to life was really great. I mean, it spiked the sales after that. There was a lot of love for that book, but getting you and Seth behind it and having her on really pushed it into the stratosphere.
It was spectacular. It was so wonderful. I think that's still one of my favorite all-time books. I love it so much.
Yeah, me too.
So you mentioned you work at Doubleday, and now you are the Senior Vice President and Deputy Publisher. Is that right?
That is right. I oversee the publicity department, have a hand in marketing as well. I've been in publishing for 22 years now, which seems kind of insane to me. You know, I was a little kid who grew up in Carterville, Illinois, population nearly 6,000. Go Carterville Lions. My family is all still there. It's about 6 hours south of Chicago. And I came from a long, long line of readers. My papa was a coal miner. And every day when he got in the elevator to go on that long ride down into the mine, there was always a book with him. And he read everything from Shakespeare to Stephen King. My uncle Dennis is an avid reader, my mom. So my whole life was surrounded by books. And in college, I supported myself by working as assistant manager. And my first 2 years, I was with Books A Million and then with Walden Books. And then after I came to New York on a church trip in 1989 with the Carterville Methodist Church, yes, I decided I was going to move to New York. So I transferred to the Walden Books at 57 Broadway, and I worked at the bookstore for 3 years. Till the last Christmas, where someone was not very nice to me when we didn't have a book. And I was like, what am I going to do? And my friend Jerry said, I have a friend who works at Random House. She's a production manager. And there's an assistant job open in publicity. And you can talk to a wall and you like to read. And I bet you'd be really good at it. And I was like, okay. And so I went on the interview and got the job. And thanks to Carol Schneider and Tom Perry, who are both legends in the biz, it opened the door to my career. I was at Bennett Cerf Random House, 201 East 50th. That's how old I am. So that was my start. And I've been at Doubleday for the past 16 years almost.
I found it so remarkable how long people in publishing stay in their jobs.
Yeah, it's one of the few industries, I think, that you can have that happen. And it's been, I mean, look, I have been so lucky. Like, you know, you do this because you love the books and the authors. It's why you and Seth have folks on, because you have that love of reading. And I think that, you know, that's what gets us going every day. The excitement of somebody new, the excitement of working with a house author. You know, publicity is the caboose of the publishing train. You know, like an editor buys the book, they edit it, they work on it together with the writer. It's then, you know, goes into production, there's a cover made, and then we start the conversation about, you know, who is the right audience for this and how are we going to reach them? And that's just been a blast for me. Like, again, you know, I'm a little book nerd, still am at 47 years old. So the thought of working with people like John Grisham and Ian McEwan and Margaret Atwood and Kevin Kwan and Aaron Morgenstern, like, it was just, who would have ever thought, you know?
Yeah. And it's still exciting. I wanted to ask about that because our worlds collided last year again when Margaret Atwood, the inimitable Margaret Atwood, came to Late Night to talk about The Testaments, which was her long-awaited sequel to Handmaid's Tale. And meeting her and watching her speak to Seth was such a treat. And I'd imagine that working directly with her was one of the more fulfilling, or has been one of the more fulfilling moments in your illustrious career.
It was awesome. Like, you know, that segment also, if any listener has not seen it, please watch. You will see Margaret Atwood read Seth's palm, which I did not know was going to happen. And it was such a great moment to see. You guys snuck me onto the set. It was so much fun. I kept the cue cards there in my office in New York.
I hope you get back there someday.
You know, who knows when, but I'm counting on. We'll get to the other side. Yeah, that was an amazing launch. You know, the book was embargoed, which means we don't send out early copies. We keep it a secret. You know, we don't share it a lot with a bunch of folks. You know, we built that campaign kind of brick by brick, and you guys were a very important part of that. That was her first TV stop in the U.S. On a long tour. And it was so funny because when we got the manuscript, we had to give it a dummy title called The Casements, and we had to give it a dummy author. Victoria Lockett was what Margaret chose. So anytime that we made photocopies, which were rare, it was that. And, you know, nothing was emailed. It was totally secret. It was just the craziest, most wonderful time. And one of the funny things that happened while we were traveling together during that week, so the amazing Lucy Feldman at Time Magazine, the book's editor there, she did an interview with Margaret, and Margaret was on the cover of Time Magazine for their fall preview. There had not been a woman writer on the cover of Time, I believe, since Toni Morrison in the 90s.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so it was really an incredible feature and an incredible thing for her to be on the cover. So anyway, we're in Dallas. We did some interviews, and Margaret says, I need to pick up a couple of things. Let's go to a drugstore. So we went to a CVS, and I got to shop with Margaret Atwood. And we're there, and we get up to the counter to pay. And the magazine rack is right there in front of us, and there is the Time magazine with her on the cover. So I just grabbed a copy, and I put it facing the cashier, and I said, we'll take this as well. And the cashier looked at it, looked at us, scanned it, put it in the bag. I was like, that'll be $32.50, you know? So, it was just a funny moment. But the other cool thing about that time was, you know, a lot of authors are not recognized on the street. It's sort of an anonymous life, you know? In a way, you still have that anonymity that maybe Seth doesn't. But when we would walk through airports or come out of interview studios or walking the streets of Manhattan, the fascinating thing was to see the young people come up to her and just this sort of, you know, moment of awe that they saw, because she's just such a legend. I mean, she's amazing.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
It's true. It is such a solitary pursuit in many ways.
Yeah, you sit in a room for a while and, you know, it could take who knows how long. I think, you know, it can be fast, it can be years, it can be forever, you know, who knows? And then you kind of leave and go out into the world and have to talk about this thing after you've written it all by yourself. It's a little bit of a surreal experience. I, you know, especially on the event side, like I've traveled a lot with John Grisham, and, you know, you go into a room and there's 1,000 people or more that are waiting to see him. And there's such a great energy. And there's, I think that's the great thing about books, is that connection. You bring your own experience to that. And then I think it's amplified when you see the author in person, because what is personal to you, they may not know. You know, art is subjective. So whatever your life experience is that you bring, or a book that saved you during a difficult time, it's a really special thing to have witnessed over the past 20 something years.
Yes, absolutely. That's very cool.
Yeah.
I found that when I started at Late Night, and we were attempting to navigate this literary landscape, I reached out to a number of publicists in order to set up meetings and get a sense of what we could do to feature authors and novelists, and also try to get the word out that Seth was a reader, a person who loved literature, and that we would be committing to this. And we found that we received the most wonderful reception, and still do, from this publishing community. And I wondered if, as a person in that community, you could kind of speak to that, because I do think now the landscape is very different. Set aside this last 9 months, but this landscape is very different from what it looked like when we launched the show in 2014.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the other thing to comment and commend you all on is that your guys' reading tastes are really wide and varied. I mean, we have an author named C.J. Hauser, who wrote a novel for us called Family of Origin, and she did a piece called The Crane Wife that ran on the Paris Review. Seth read it that morning and then contacted you, and then you contacted me. I mean, that was just this amazing connection that we were able to do for that booking, and it was all because of how you guys read, you know? And I think also these days we're very lucky to have the morning shows have authors on,
yes.
You know, there's some late night, but you guys are really consistent in promoting diverse voices and also debut voices, which may not happen in other outlets. Also, like, Seth is hilarious. I love him, you know, and seeing him with people and authors, I think that he's able to draw out questions and things that others may not be able to. And plus, your segments are long.
Yeah, it is nice to be able to have the time to talk to them. And I think it makes such a difference. At least you can tell, I think, in any perspective, when someone is really devoted to whatever the person's project is. And
yeah.
He's so devoted to reading that I think that comes through nicely, which is very good.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about something that you started doing in March, which was, for those that don't follow you on Instagram, they can after this interview, but you started posting a series of images, which you had taken.
Yes.
Beautiful pictures from your trips all over the world. And you accompanied them with hopeful thoughts or memories or ideas that were things we could collectively be happy about. And it became this regular practice for you. and it turned into a book deal, which is amazing. And I know that was not your intention when you started. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about why you started doing that and then how that all came together.
Sure. It is one of the craziest things that has ever happened to me in my life. And again, this is a refrain that you will hear me say. I am very lucky because this all just started, as you said, sort of, it actually started the day that the WHO declared the pandemic. I believe it was March 11th. And a friend of mine describes life as people carry around an invisible bag of rocks. And some of those bags are heavier than others. And sometimes there are more rocks and sometimes there are fewer rocks, but everybody has that. And the reason I started doing it is that it had just become such an uncertain time. It was for me truly to just ground myself of things that made me happy. So the lists are called Happy Making Things in a Difficult World. And it's everything from a piece of art to food, to a memory, to a feeling, to photography, to a book, to lines from movies, any little thing like a fat goldfish or an Elizabeth Payton painting or Lobby Baby by Seth made it in because we love that special, Schitt's Creek, which I became obsessed with during the pandemic. And of course, Lin-Manuel.
You always Lin-Manuel. End the same way, yes.
Yeah, I always end with, and it bears repeating, Lin-Manuel Miranda. I am obsessed with Hamilton. I think he's a genius. But I started doing it almost every day, you know, and then usually on the weekends, I started doing a list called things you might consider doing today or things you might consider doing this weekend. Again, that's everything from read this piece by this person that I've found and loved or reorganize the junk drawer. It can be anything. And anyway, I built up a lot and then an amazing agent named Brittany Bloom contacted me and said, I think this is a book. And I had a few other friends who had told me, you could do this. Like, this should be a book. You should put it all together. So it will come out next October from Penguin. It's going to be a trade paperback original. We wanted to keep it under $20. It is the lists that have been published, but I've also done about 50% new ones. I've written playlists. I've written about 16 longer essays. Things that are important to me are universal enough, but it's all about taking that sort of 5 minutes to read these things and just find that piece of joy. You know, there's a fine line between memory and discovery, a friend of mine had said. And so my hope in these, in the book, and if folks go find my page on Instagram, it's Todd with 2 D's, A Dowdy on Instagram. My hope is that there's something that sparks a happy memory for you. There's something that you might like that I liked and you remember that. Or, you know, you may not know a painting that I reference or a song that I reference or something else, or you may not like what I've posted, but it might spark you to think of something that does. So it basically was just a way of kind of grounding everything. Okay, the world is kind of terrifying at large. Let's just take a moment to remember a few little things that make us happy. So the book is going to be called Little Pieces of Hope, out next year.
I am so excited for it.
Thanks. Thank you.
I've loved looking at the posts, and I know I've told you this before, but it was a very remarkable thing you did, and I'm so excited that people are going to see it on in a different medium.
I still am absolutely gobsmacked that this is happening. You know, like there's...
That's how all the best things are.
It's true. You know, when I was in college, we became obsessed with John Grisham novels. Me, my roommates, Jeremy and Casey, like we devoured them. I was working in the bookstore at the time. And so I wrote him a letter, I believe after the Pelican Brief. And in 1992, John wrote back to me. And I still have it. I still have the envelope. And I am his publicist now and have been for the past 5 years. And it has been just one of the most sort of magical things in my life. Like, it's crazy.
That's so great.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of you. It's really, really exciting. And I'm looking forward to getting my signed copy of your book.
I will make that happen.
Lastly, I want to end with any books that you would like to recommend to our listeners that you've either read recently or over the past 9 months.
I have discovered the Canadian mystery writer Louise Penny. She has the Inspector Armand Gamache series set in Three Pines, and I've become obsessed with that. The first book in the series is Still Life, which is great. She has a very wicked sense of humor and a razor-sharp brain, and I think the twists in that novel I was really surprised by. Loved that. We have a novel called Bathhouse coming out next June by this gentleman named P.J. Vernon, and I swear that it is the closest thing that I have read to Gone Girl in a long, long time. And the seemingly perfect couple of Oliver and Nathan give Nick and Amy from Gone Girl a run for the money. And then lastly, I reread Charlotte's Web about a month ago. And now all these years later, when I reread it, it still packs a wallop. Like E.B. White gets real. Like, you know, it was a great reread, and I have a stack of stuff to get through the winter. One of the goals is Robert Caro's Lyndon Johnson biography series.
Thank you so much, Todd, for taking the time, and I can't wait to see you in real life soon.
Right back at you. Thank you so much for asking me. This is just completely wonderful, and I was happy to do it.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Seth again. The late night staff is full of voracious readers. Here are some recommendations on what we've been reading lately.
My name is Dina Gasovsky. I am a writer here at Late Night. I wanted to recommend The End of October by Lawrence Wright in case you aren't freaked out enough about what's going on. He basically did investigative reporting, interviewing public health officials, experts, scientists on our preparedness for a pandemic. And it was eerily published back in April. It focuses on a Fauci-like character who witnesses an outbreak. So if you want to escape reality, this is probably not the book for you. But if you want to be super creeped out about how realistic it is, you might want to check it out. And Wright also wrote The Looming Tower, which was turned into a television series. So again, read at your own peril, but it is fascinating.
Hi, everybody. I'm Eli Janney from the HE Band, and I have a book recommendation for you guys. The one that I've been enjoying during this strange, otherworldly time we're living through is The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami. I love this book because it's a very sort of dreamy, Alice in Wonderland kind of adventure story. It's rooted in reality, but it really goes off the rails in parts and gets very, very strange. This is a translation by Jay Rubin. And I love the prose on it. It's very easy to read. It's very strange, but very interesting. And the story pulls you along. I just really love this book. It was originally written as a series that were published separately. And this is putting them all together. So sometimes it jumps around a little bit. But I feel like that just adds to the overall dreamy quality of it. So that's my book recommendation.
This has been Late Night Lit. Our thanks to Disha Filia and Todd Dowdy. Our theme music was written and performed by the HE Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jinks Daly. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the new Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.